Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including Intelligence Squared US, Oxford-style debates live from New York City. Intelligence Squared US brings together the world's leading authorities on the day's most important issues for intelligent discussion, grounded in facts and informed by reasoned analysis. Rethink your point of view, you know we'd like to do that, with Intelligence Squared US. Find it on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we're returning to the arena to talk about The Hunger Games: Catching Fire. Can Katniss defeat President Snow? Will she kiss anybody? And can Elizabeth Banks see through her eyelashes? Then, as we head into what will be a gift-giving season for many of us, we'll talk about pop culture gift-giving and what's left of it in a digital age. What can you still give people that you can put in a box with a bow? And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Kat Chow, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a blogger and social media producer for Code Switch.
And Audie Cornish, plucky upstart, what do you do at NPR?
I am a co-host of All Things Considered.
Well, as you have heard, this is our lineup for the week. We have reconstituted a little bit.
That's right.
And, you know, Kat is coming off her big week. I just wanted to give a shout out. Kat, who runs the @todayin1963 Twitter account. You might not be surprised to hear the cat had a big week.
I would imagine.
It was a big week, yeah.
On the old Today in 1960. How did you do, Kat?
We did well. So last Friday was the 50th anniversary of President John F. Kennedy's assassination. So as you can imagine.
That on Today.
Yeah, just a little bit. So you might.
Did that come up? It wasn't just like, Governor Connolly rides motorcade.
Yeah, I accidentally tweeted about it like once. So if you rewind those tweets, you might see a reference to it.
Well, wonderful. You've got presumably a little bit left to go in that project.
Yes, we're going to finish it throughout the year, and I have no idea if we're going to do it for Today in 1964. We'll see about that.
That is fantastic. I'm so happy for you that went so well, and I just wanted to give that a little shout. And then we are going to talk about The Hunger Games: Catching Fire. Now, I went back today and I listened to, we did do a show about the original Hunger Games movie back when it came out, which was longer ago than I thought.
Yeah, I have no recollection of talking about it on this show.
Well, Audie Cornish, are you a Hunger Games person? Do you follow this series?
Absolutely not. I'm coming to it completely cold.
That is so cool.
Yes, it is cool, actually, because I really don't know what's going to happen, whereas all of the ninth graders sitting around me at the Saturday night showing that I went to clearly did.
Did you see the first one?
I did.
You did see the first one.
On a plane, though.
Right.
See, I'm not truly committed.
With no sound. It landed before the ending, so you weren't sure how those turned out.
I think I know how it ended.
Yeah, you think she lives. Yeah. That girl I keep seeing in the second one, I think she must have lived.
Catnip long or whatever. To be in Silver Linings Playbook, and that's where old people like me come in.
Yeah, old people like me, too. Well, what did you think of it coming into a cold on the Saturday showing full of ninth graders?
I loved it. I thought it did something that it's hard for these big comic booky trilogy type things to do, which is to make a decent second installment that like advances the story and is still super engaging and that you can walk in on even if you don't know everything that's going on.
Even though they don't do a lot of previously on.
No, they don't. I noticed in the scene where she says she knew Rue, they don't really explain any of that. They just kind of assume that you know that she had this relationship with this girl in the first movie.
And well, they also have a hashtag in the bottom left-hand corner of the screen that says sad.
That is a filthy lie. That is a filthy lie. Yeah, I kind of thought this one, as a movie, I liked this one better than the first one, I think, which is not an original observation. That's something that I am not alone in that. But I don't know. I think I liked it better in the first one as a movie. I thought it was.
Have you all read the books? I mean, am I totally in the deficit here?
I have read the books. Yes.
This is one of the incredibly few chances I have to say I have read the books.
Oh, I'm the only one. All right. So for the guys who read the books, I mean, really?
Yeah. Well, the thing about the books is, I mean, I think in some ways this movie is a little bit easier to make because it's a little more plot It's a little more plotty.
The world building has happened in the first installment.
And I think you're a little bit less limited by the fact that you don't have her internal monologue quite as much, because the books are really built from her internal monologue. And I think in the first one, when you're trying to set up the story and you're trying to introduce characters, it's very tough to, without her talking about her feelings and her fears and all that stuff, it's hard to get a rich story. Whereas this is where the politics are really kicking in more heavily, the complex politics, as opposed to just the dystopian politics of the first one, where because it's all so terrible, they have this terrible competition.
Well, and one of the tricky things with these movies, and one of the biggest challenges, and I'm not sure there's a great way to get around it, is that because you can't establish this coming entirely from her, you have to show other characters interacting outside of her sphere.
Right.
So you have a lot of Donald Sutherland as President Snow stating subtext as text and sort of saying, hope. Forgive them hope.
Mostly with his eyebrows.
Mostly with his... I mean, he has a full beard, but there's definitely a mustache for twirling there, too.
So, as he cuts those roses.
Yeah. and so you have, quite a bit more villain sits around talking about his motivations than I think is necessary. Like I said, subtext.
He's so good, though.
He is good.
He's so good, though. I could just sit there and watch Donald Sutherland talk about how he needs to crush people. I can listen to a lot of that.
But this movie, I too prefer this movie considerably to the previous one. And it should be noted, it's got twice as much of a budget.
Mm-hmm.
And elements of the first movie I really did think looked a little cheap in ways that this one doesn't. And it's not necessarily just it's a sequel, so it's more and bigger. Particularly the scenes in the Capitol and the people in the Capitol are more convincingly rendered as these grotesque,
very extreme.
Yeah. And kind of bouncing off what you were saying, Elizabeth Banks' character, Effie, kind of came to life more so in the second movie. I actually watched both of them back to back. I had seen the first movie maybe when it had first come out. And then yesterday when I went to go see it, I just watched both of them in a row.
Yeah, I did the same thing.
Yeah. And that actually helped a lot, because in the first movie, the character Effie was kind of grating on me. There was something a little too delicate about her character. And then as she progressed to the second one, you sort of saw her develop. Like, she had these hesitations toward Katniss and PETA having to
She's more ambivalent in the second
movie. Yeah, and I think that really came out, and something about Elizabeth Banks's mannerisms, the anxiety that she brought, was a nice difference that I enjoyed a lot.
I liked that performance. She actually made me tear up a little bit at one point. I sort of thought, well, that's unexpected.
Yeah.
I mean, I might have just been in that kind of mood. but it was unexpected to me. She does have that sort of halting, I think ambivalent is a very good word for that. She's wondering about her role in all of this, and how much is she supposed to be supporting Katniss and PETA versus is she part of this? She's part of this bigger machine and all that business. I think we all felt at the time that the reaping was the strongest scene in the first movie.
Yeah.
And I think the kind of re-reaping in this movie is very different,
but
also a very moving and very sad sequence.
Well, if you look at Effie, and I think Effie's a really interesting character, her defining characteristic is obliviousness. On the surface.
It seems to be.
Yeah.
But I think that really her defining characteristic is cautiousness. And a sense that she has a role to play. And so she is very much she's a company woman. And is very, very careful about how, never to editorialize beyond what her role is. And so the fact that you get a lot more acting in her face, a lot more acting with the eyes, is a nice improvement.
Which has to do through all that.
All that makeup.
Eyelashes.
There's a commitment to very, very awesome eyelashes.
It's really true. The eyelashes
the costume
especially.
Department.
Yeah. I thought the eyelashes especially. Like, she's got obviously lots of prosthetics and add-ons of various kinds, but the eyelashes in particular, I was like, boy, that would be... I mean, I have occasionally worn regular false eyelashes, and they are so distracting.
They're awesome. What are you talking about?
No, they're awesome, but they distract me, too. And so when I look at the
With
ones
your
that
hotness.
Are like... I didn't say I didn't like them. And when I look at ones that are like 2 inches long and bright pink, I just think I would do nothing but feel like I was looking through grass the entire
time.
Or
like there are spiders on your eyes.
Right. totally.
You just took it to a dark place.
I know. I'm sorry I went there.
Yeah, I can't say that I would necessarily emulate the Effie Trinket look, but I agree that character...
Speak for yourself, Holmesy.
That character deepened somewhat. And the other thing I think comes into play in this movie is you do learn a little bit more about her relationships with these two guys that she's interested in, which in the first movie, we talked at the time about the fact that they were very elided, very much elided, both of those relationships. Like, you barely saw Gale at all.
Yeah, they don't do as much. I mean, the book, you know, partly you have these ruminative scenes of her in the woods,
right,
where they're really establishing her, a lot of her thoughts about a lot of things, which they clearly can't do in a movie like this. But I actually think they still haven't done that much with Gale. They
right.
do more with Gale in the second movie, but you get a little bit less of a sense of why she's so, you know, what he represents to her and why she has such a powerful bond with him, even though the movie is about this shared struggle that she has with this other guy.
Mm-hmm.
At
mm-hmm.
the same time, I really appreciated that about the film, especially as something that young women are looking up to. I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't want to do any kind of spoilers, but at one point her character says essentially, like, I'm a little busy with my trauma right now.
Yeah.
I can't be in love with you.
Yeah.
And you know what? Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
You know?
It's true.
You spent the last couple of years, you know, fighting people and trying not to lead a rebellion. Like, you're busy.
Right.
You don't have time to date. And
exactly.
I loved that moment. I was like, yeah, you go later.
Yeah.
Get married when you're 30.
Exactly.
Well, and one of the things I said to Stephen after we saw the movie that I wrote about today on the blog, it's Monday and I wrote about today, is that in a lot of ways, PETA is a very, very traditional movie love interest, but he's a very traditional female love interest.
This is the one, like, that gets carried around a bit?
If you,
yes.
If you looked at, and I, you know, this was the exact kind of post where you write it, and then if people only read the headline, they completely misunderstand what you're saying. But it's not to say that you know, that if you are the physically weaker and the more in need of rescue, that you somehow are the woman, right?
Right.
But in Hollywood, that's a girlfriend. He is in basically the same position as Gwyneth Paltrow in Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
And Emma Stone in Spider-Man, and all these women who, like, they're strong. They're not pushovers.
The filmmakers have taken care to make them strong characters.
They're likable. They're strong characters. But in the end, the big stakes at the end are going to be they've gotten themselves into some ridiculous mess, and you have to go and rescue them and save them. And so she winds up running around saving him quite a bit. And he's the one who stands there and tells her to get in touch with her feelings and everything.
Yeah.
It's very much a traditional movie girlfriend. And that doesn't mean that in real life that's always what the role of women is at all. But in movies, if you're looking at Hollywood, that's typically the action movie girlfriend when you have
he's there to soften her.
Yeah.
Exactly, which I think is really cool.
And also he seems like a very reasonable character. So there's this instance where he should be really angry at Katniss, where she's basically ignored him. But he goes up to her and he starts trying to get to know her.
Mm-hmm.
And he has such a likable quality that is so different than Katniss. Like, they're supposed to be really different anyway. That's
right.
How it's set up. But he's kind of a subtle character. And I think that totally fits in line with how he's the quote-unquote girlfriend.
There's a kind of lack of vanity, I think, in the way that Josh Hutcherson plays that part. That it doesn't come with a lot of swagger.
Right.
He's kind of a short guy. It's like for a movie boyfriend, you know, he's comfortable kind of playing this more nurturing person, which I think is really unusual and interesting. And, you know, he's physically strong, but he's not as strong as she is.
Right.
She could kick his butt and everybody knows it. Like, her, him, everybody knows that she could kick his butt. And that's very unusual for a movie boyfriend-girlfriend kind of arrangement.
But given all that, that makes the other love interest being more fleshed out, more important, right? And I think this is where Stephen's criticism really makes a lot of sense. This other character, Gale, like, I don't know why she's into him, right, compared to this other person who we've listed a lot of kind of, like, dubious movie boyfriend qualities. I mean, he makes bread, which is awesome, so already I'm into
And he
it,
can paint. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And the Gale character is traditionally, especially in the books, it's really fleshed out, is there as a provider. Is there, like, when she leaves to go fight in the games, it is assumed that she will die and that he will then be charged with taking care of her mother and sister, that he's much more in the role of a kind of traditional protector. But you really don't, like, he just isn't in those first two movies very much. Now, he's much more in Mockingjay, and I'm sure that he will be a much more prominent character in the two movies that they're making out of that completely bonkers book. But it's still not a fair fight between them in these
it's
movies.
It's not a fair fight yet, because what you get eventually is much more of that tension between, like, Peeta is a more kind of nurturing, gentler sort of guy, and Gale is a more typical kind of, he's the bigger, kind of more forceful in this movie.
He's also angrier.
Like, yeah, and kind of brooding.
But he also has more of a revolutionary spirit.
Oh, yes. No, he's more into the revolution, at least at this stage of the story. He's definitely more of a revolutionary.
Now, does this feel like a more adult kind of love triangle to you guys than other films? By other films, I mostly mean Twilight, where the choices between your paramours, I don't know, there's something about, obviously Twilight's different, and I don't want the people to write in and say they hate me for saying this, but I felt like that female character was a lot more passive.
Right,
But in this one, I almost feel like these are choices actual adult women would make in real life between,
absolutely,
like, a guy who bakes bread and a guy who's gonna, like, do some other providery thing. I mean, not to be all heteronormative, this is NPR, but
Of course.
It just felt very different, and I wondered about it because the audience for this movie, I think over half are over the age of 25.
And I saw that too.
Yeah, interesting numbers that came out about kind of who went to see it.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, and I think that's kind of why I think the gender stuff in this movie is so interesting, is that you get her in a kind of more traditionally alpha-like role. And so, I mean, she partly has a different set of love interests because she's very different from Bella in Twilight.
And that's, again, another reason I'm really interested in Mockingjay, is they continue to flesh out the Johanna Mason character, played by Jenna Malone, as another alpha. Mm-hmm. That how often do you see movies like this in which there are multiple competing alpha women?
Yeah. No, that's true. That's absolutely true.
That's a good point.
I mean, talk about your Bechdel test.
No, that is very true. And they talk almost never about me. They hardly ever have that conversation.
They don't argue about boys. I don't understand it.
Not very much they don't. That's for sure.
One thing for me that was kind of a conversation callback to the first film is, you know, the whole controversy over casting and, like, the actress who played Rue being a black actress. And I kind of like that in this film, they, like, double, triple down on all of that. They're like, she's black, her mom is black, her sisters are.
Well, her
whole district.
Her district.
People in that district.
Yeah, but the thing is, it was a thing, right? Like, in the first movie, people complaining about it. And this movie's like, now you're wrong.
Well, the notion that black people don't exist in this dystopian world is ludicrous.
Well, and it's true to the book. I mean, in the book, Rue is clearly a black person.
I only know what I hear from Twitter, and everyone's so upset.
It was very strange. Because there were a bunch of people who were like, why is Rue black? Like, and I still think it was kind of a fringy reaction.
Right.
But I remember it had a lot of steam. There were just so many people who were saying that.
Yeah, and it's bizarre because if you go back and read the book.
Right, it's plain in the
it's
book.
It's plain as day that's what's being described. It's just that she doesn't say, like, she's a black girl. She talks about her having dark brown skin and dark brown eyes and stuff like that. And you're like, oh, I get it. She's a black person. And then you get people who are like, I just assumed she had a really deep tan. Like, and then you're trying to explain, like, no, it was obvious in the book, especially since the book takes place in a dystopian future of the United States.
Oh, right. But, you know, people of color are always left out of dystopian everything, right? If it wasn't for The Matrix, we'd have nothing,
If it wasn't for The Walking Dead, there'd be no...
But even then, we're always getting killed off of that, though. The Matrix was like, people are on high councils, they were generals, and another thing, it was like, everybody was all there. Yeah. And with this, I just thought, obviously, when I'm watching the picture, it made a whole lot of sense, but because I didn't read the books, I didn't know, like, maybe there was some ambiguity there, and that's why this was a thing.
The next step in progress on this is that the black character would survive.
Yeah, yeah, that's actually
a lot
true.
There, Mr. Jensen.
It's true. Well, and the funny thing is that the bigger ambiguity was that in the book, Katniss herself and her family appear to be more, I guess I would say, like, they sound kind of Mediterranean or something like that. They sound more like there's discussion of the fact that she is olive-skinned and she has, you know,
yeah,
this
a
really
little bit more brown,
hair.
Maybe. I actually read somewhere earlier today that she played a good, quote-unquote, portrayal of an Indian warrior. I had no idea that that was supposed to be what she was in the books. I mean, I'll have to go back and read it.
But. Yeah, I think it's, like I said, I think it's ambiguous in the books. Like, exactly. I don't think they ever say that, but it is clear that she does not come off like she would be a pale-skinned, blue-eyed blonde.
Yeah.
Like, it's, but like, it's, which is why she has, like, the, why they went to the trouble of making Jennifer Lawrence dark-haired. Anyway, whether you're interested in that or some other aspect of this interesting movie and interesting trilogy, you should go and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. All right. It is that time of year when many, not all, but many are turning their thoughts to gifts of some sort, gifts for the relatives, gifts for the friends, gifts for the person who manages your apartment building, whatever. It's gift giving season. And what prompted this topic is that Stephen and I got to talking about the fact that, you know, whether you like to give books, whether you like to give movies, whether
music.
You like to give music, whether you like to give games, it's more and more turning out that everybody just wants to go download everything, which means you're pretty much left giving a gift card, which for me, not the most satisfying thing to
used
get.
Used to be depressing to get a gift card, right? The thought
was
like,
it?
You now, didn't take any time out to give me a gift. You went to the mall customer service desk.
Exactly.
That's actually still how I feel. It's like, you actually went on Amazon.com and just got this Kindle.
I never feel cheated as the recipient, but as the giver, I do not find it a fun gift to give a gift card.
I don't know if this is some sort of gender dynamic that is emerging here, but to me, gift cards make complete sense as gifts. Like, I can't tell you how many gifts I have given to various relatives, at the holidays, and then it just kind of gets thrown on the pile, and it's like, oh, it's got a gift receipt with it so I can give it back for money. Like, I don't quite understand why gift cards have to be thought of as thoughtless gifts, when in fact what it is it's a ticket to go shopping for free.
Yes, economists agree with you, by the way, that gifts don't make any sense, that it makes more sense to give money. So, yeah, it's not a stretch.
But the nice thing about the gift card as opposed to cash, which cash does seem gauche, as much as everybody wants it.
Yeah.
The gift card is you get yourself something special here. You go peruse the virtual racks until you find something you like.
Are gift cards less gauche than cash?
I saw your face. You were like disagreeing.
You get to choose
is that valid?
Do you box the cash up or is it?
And do you with the cash, do you say you can only buy books with this? Or?
Like if I tape cash to an old gift
card,
the cash
gift wrap is awesome.
I think, but I mean, cash has this like an older relative sending a card to a child.
I used to love those
cards. I loved those cards too.
Best cards ever.
Exactly.
Well, yeah.
That's it. But I understand why adults don't want to give, because then you're just exchanging cash, and it becomes like the cheaper relative is the one who comes out ahead.
Right. You should just do the net. Be like, okay, so the net is I give you $5.
Right.
Because I was going to give you
I owe you money, actually.
You were going to give me $20. So I just give you $5 and we forget the whole thing. And theoretically, if you have even-handed relationships, then you would give nothing to anyone.
Nothing to anyone.
Because everyone's just exchanging the same amount of cash if it's a wealth transfer. Now, but here's the funny thing. This is why Stephen Thompson is blowing my mind here. Because let me just very briefly delve into the personal story of what it is like to become friends with Stephen Thompson. And this happened when we did not live in the same city. Neither one of us worked at NPR yet. And The process of becoming friends with Stephen Thompson is he starts sending you things to influence you, the things that you must know.
See, that's kind of nice.
He starts to send you. Like, he would send me a little, I would open like a package, and there would be like 5 CDs in it. And it would be like, this is what you're supposed to go and listen to become a better person.
Well, no, but that I think you would like based on what I know of your
I know, but this is what I'm saying.
I don't mean to out you, but what year is this? He's mailing you a playlist.
2004 or 2005.
Okay. 2004, 2005, yeah, 2005 mostly. But the point I'm trying to make, that Stephen's talking about why are gift cards, like, not that awesome. And what I'm saying is it's super awesome when somebody says, I picked this out because I thought that it would be something that you particularly would like. And that's what's missing from a gift card exchange.
And I guess part of it for me, and I know this is my thing and not necessarily something I advise for everybody, but I love giving gifts when I am not obligated to do so. So for me, when it becomes, you know, I've got a list of people and I'm checking them off, like, there's not that serendipity of you realize that somebody would love something, and so you just get it for them.
Yeah.
And that's so much more surprising and thoughtful than these obligatory, you know, oh, I have gotten you a gift based on what I, you know, like.
Or this is what was on your list.
Right. And that, where you're just picking up a piece of somebody's shopping list or their wedding registry or whatever. And so, you know, I always like the idea of the gift as a surprise. Right. But once you get to, you know, Christmas or whatever, then it's just, then why not just, like, here, get yourself something nice.
Yeah. So actually, something that you were saying, Stephen, made me realize that I'm actually a really selfish and probably horrible gift giver. So when I give gifts, I always give people gifts that are things that I kind of enjoy that I just want the other person to really like so that we can talk about it.
Yeah.
And especially with my dad, for example, he lives in Connecticut. I'm here in D.C. And the way we've sort of established our relationship is that, like, I'll email him links to things and he'll give these really, like, pithy one sentence, you know, comments on that. But for gifts, it's kind of like that, too, for books that I've been reading that I'm hoping he'll like so he knows that I'm, like, a smart person. No, not quite that. I'm just kidding. But, like, for my sisters, I'll give them, like, purses that I eventually want, things like that.
that have cat embroidered on them?
Yeah, exactly. I'm looking for a cat purse for my oldest sister that I
can
get.
The question is, what's the answer, I guess, originally, the way we got to this long ago? When I grew up, you gave a book or you gave a, at the time, tape or CD. Or, you know, later on, you gave a DVD or you gave a something. And now it's just kind of like everybody just wants to download things for themselves. So what
or
can
stream,
you...
Or stream it. Yeah. You know,
or
so
stream
much
it.
Of that stuff is on the Roku.
Well, exactly. Like, DVD box sets, for their brief life of being really super popular, were a great splurgy gift. And now everybody just wants to stream everything.
No, we're going to see the comeback of that, of the fetish object, right?
You think?
Like, you know, every book is going to be a coffee table book. Like, the cookbooks are going to be glossier. You're going to start looking at that Dylan box set and being like, yeah, that's a good idea. It's like epic backup. Like, all of these things that you would essentially in the past have been like, that's an indulgence. Now it makes more sense in a gift-giving context. And one thing to challenge Stephen, philosophical question, can you ever really gift a digital object? It doesn't belong to you. I'm, like, going to get on my little soapbox now. It belongs to whatever digital entity you've downloaded it from, right? You've licensed
but
it.
But not necessarily.
So it's like Merry
giving...
Christmas. You're licensing this until someone decides you're going to yank it off the digital shelf or off your computer. I mean, I feel very strongly that we don't own these things in
right.
the same way.
No, and I...
And therefore, how do you gift them?
Well, yeah, and you and I think we're fundamentally in agreement. I really like to have physical manifestations of the popular culture I like. I love DVD box sets. I love CDs. You know, so to me, the whole notion of the cloud, yeah, I've actually talked about this a little bit on the show, that I don't trust it. I feel like, yeah, like it can be taken away at any time. But keep in mind that a gift card is not just, we're not just talking about the iTunes store. We're, you know, it could be Amazon. It could be a day spa. It could be, you know, it could be whatever. It doesn't necessarily have to be an ephemeral object that you're acquiring with your gift card.
But what is the answer to those of us
That's
who
a great, yeah.
those of us who like to give a physical object and nobody wants one.
A thumb drive.
A thumb drive. Well, this was one of my gadgets.
Oh, that's like getting a toaster just for the modern age. You open that up.
Hey, people
like,
still
oh,
need
yay,
people
USB.
Still need toast. People still toast. Don't they?
People still need toast. There's no digital toast. Well, that's kind of what I was thinking. Was like, are you reduced to the fact that you have to buy, like, the piece of electronics itself, and mm-hmm. those are way too expensive.
Right.
So it's kind of like, you can't just buy a game, like, you have to buy the actual, like, unless you're ready to trade up to getting the person the Xbox One.
Well, but keep in mind, you've got
to be really serious about somebody to buy them the Xbox One.
Well, yeah, like hundreds of dollars, or the Wii U.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing where, like, every once in a while you get really ambitious and you're like, oh, I'm going to get this person, like, a Wii or something like that. But then you wind up in that situation, like, I'm not necessarily going to say I once gave both of my parents Palm devices, but I might have. And, of course, like, you never know what somebody else is going to successfully use and what's going to be useful to them. And I don't know.
I think that's the biggest risk, right, when you're buying someone an expensive digital gift, because you don't know what their habits are. And then when they finally have that one piece of equipment, you're like, oh, yeah, I will buy you an e-book for
$10. I need to hang out with you guys more often. I mean, you're talking really big gifts here. here's a framed photo of you and me doing a thing. Why? Because
right.
No one prints photos anymore.
No one has frames anymore.
That's a perfect example. That's a good answer.
Oh, and it stays there forever.
This is what I'm looking for.
I didn't know I could get such cool stuff if I had been hanging out with you guys.
Audie's like, I'm just saying, I was this close
department.
To a Palm device.
That's what I
think. Exactly. I'm just going to take your Roku back to the store.
Oh, my God. If you had mentioned a stylus, I think I'd have to make out with you.
Yeah, it's... Hey, I...
You guys can cut that.
I do. I am one of these people where, like, kind of like what Steven said, like, I'll have no ideas for gifts, and so they'll be really kind of, like, chintzy, and I won't feel good about them. And then all of a sudden, I'll get an idea, and I'll buy something for someone that's, like, totally extravagant, because I sort of, like, kind of flit around trying to figure out what I want to do, and I don't know. And the funny thing about actual physical objects, though, is that the best luck I've had recently with physical objects kind of feels like a cheat as a gift, because what happens is I get sent a lot of DVDs for work.
Right.
And there are a couple of providers of DVDs who send me a ton of stuff that, like, my parents love. And, like, if I round up a bunch of that stuff...
Oh, I do that all the time with CDs.
Which I just kind of rolled in.
You are outing the NPR gift-giving guy.
I'm just saying. There's a certain amount of stuff. There's a certain amount of stuff that comes in that, like, if I were to pass that along, that would actually be the thing that would be most popular. But I didn't pay for it, so I can't really consider it a gift.
Yeah, and that's something I definitely do year round. I never wrap the crate of CDs that I send to my friends back in Madison for their coffee shop. But I think that Audie's idea of a framed photo really is a nice idea. And what you want to think about, I guess, if you need physical manifestations that you can hand people, is just think about stuff that can never be turned into, that can never be soaked into the ether. You know, clothing. You know,
like a scarf,
like a or a pop culture happy hour T-shirt.
Soon to exist.
But on the photo frame thing, it's not just that; it's doing, you know, old timey stuff that we don't do anymore, right? So, like, getting stationery is really nice because everyone thinks they're going to write a note, but they never have any nice paper, They never have stamps.
Yeah.
I mean, putting together things that, like, we have digital versions of them, I think, is still feels like a gift.
Yeah.
Well, and remember, board games, there are certain things that you're not able to simulate.
Oh, no. Yeah. You're my dad. I have so many board games from my father.
Yeah, that's true.
Obscure ones. They were never good ones. Like, they were, sorry, Dad. They were never, like, the ones everyone had commercials of, you know? Mm-hmm. It was always, like, Hungry, Hungry Rhinoceros. Or, like, you know, like,
slightly
cheaters, like, not checkers, like, another version. I don't know.
Yeah, actually, I think board games are making a huge resurgence, at least in my life. Like, my family plays Settlers of Catan now during holidays, and it's really weird because we get very vicious. So that's a good idea for my dad.
Yeah. I guess I should be grateful that I have my relatives that I can shop for, which are some of them, and then I have my relatives who really just want money.
Yeah.
I should just give them gift cards.
What about your new work friends who want the latest Xbox?
Yeah.
You didn't mention them.
Well, hey, you know, Audie, we're very grateful that you're on our show. So you never know.
I mean, I'm not really getting paid to do this.
You're not.
So
this is off the clock for me, too.
I was going to say, Audie is sitting here at the end of a day when she has already hosted a perfectly good national radio show. I mean, come on.
They told me there'd be Wii.
Well, there's not. I wish there were. But I think what we will do is, we will just welcome all of the suggestions that everyone can think of to inspire me for gift giving if I continue to resent gift cards. And I should point out, like I said, I never feel cheated as the recipient. Happy to go and
you
spend money.
Chase that feeling.
No. I'm happy to go. I never feel let down as the recipient at all. I love to spend a gift card, but as a giver,
You want to feel special. You want to feel like the sort of person who did something special.
No.
That's all it is. If you are happy to receive them, why would other people not be happy to receive them?
I want to feel like I expressed my personal affection.
Put it
not
in a bigger box.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm telling you. Just put it in an enormous gift box. It gets a laugh every time. Not that I've done this.
Excellent.
Weigh it down with some old shoes or something.
I remember buying my kids Nintendo DSIs and wrapping them in new underwear and then putting it in a big box.
Bet that went over well. All right. At any rate, as we said before, come and find us on Facebook or come and find us on the blog and tell us all of your fantastic ideas for breaking my mental block about gift giving this holiday season. And that brings us to our final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I went, not only did I see Catching Fire this weekend, but I also went and saw the movie Nebraska, which is directed by Alexander Payne, who did Election, About Schmidt, and Sideways, and The Descendants. And this is obviously his new film, very different from his others. It's shot in black and white. It's unlike Sideways and The Descendants, which are set among very affluent people. This is set in Montana and Nebraska, and about the sort of people who are generally not depicted in the movies. And they're not necessarily rendered as grotesques, but they are a very specific kind of folks that I grew up among. You know, much of the movie is set in Hawthorne, Nebraska, and it's not that much unlike rural Wisconsin where I grew up. And it's not a perfect movie. The script can be a little wobbly in spots. It stars Will Forte and Bruce Dern. There's a wonderful performance by June Squibb as the kind of sour maternal figure in this family. But there are a bunch of these wonderfully detailed scenes. There's this wonderful scene where all the men in the family are sitting, staring straight ahead at a game and just making incredibly banal chit-chat with each other in ways that struck me as very, very true. There's some wonderful acting in it. There's just a lot of just very truthful scenes about people in parts of the country that are never really depicted in a very truthful way.
So Nebraska.
Nebraska.
Wonderful. Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
Well, we kind of touched on it in the beginning of this conversation, but the Twitter feed at Today in 1963 took over so much of my week last week that it is the only thing, basically, that existed in my life. So, therefore, it is one of the few things that made me happy last week. And I think for good reasons, kind of to backtrack, Today in 1963 was this project that I've been doing where I've been live tweeting facts from the year of 1963, which was monumental for civil rights, but also because of JFK's assassination, which I brought up. And I had so much anxiety for last week that it was really wonderful to see sort of the timeline of the events unfolding before everything. And I can't even imagine what it was like to cover the assassination back in 63. But if you're interested in checking it out, you can go ahead and see that. But that was a phenomenal day for me last week.
How much did you work ahead, or did you try to live as if you were in real time?
Oh, no, I worked about 2.5 weeks ahead of time. And then the day of, I remember just pacing around my desk, being really nervous because I had scheduled out a lot of the tweets so that they were in TweetDeck, the service that I use. And I kept wondering and fearing that I would have accidentally tweeted them from @catchat, which was my personal account.
Which would have been very confusing, you announcing the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah, Kennedy has died. But the flavors of the day were just amazing. Like, I know so much about the assassination that I never thought I did. So it was a good project.
Fantastic. At Today in 1963, still going on, still a fun feed, and check it out because Kat did some great work there past week. Plucky upstart Audie Cornish.
I only have shallow things.
That's perfectly fine.
Things,
me
very...
too. Mine is shallower than
good.
Yours, I promise.
Yay. Okay. So I have two things. I'll be brief. One is actually another NPR podcast. It's called NPR Microphone Check.
Oh, yeah.
It is the hip-hop podcast, which is run by one of our editors, Franny Kelly, and Ali Shaheed Muhammad, who's from a tribe called Quest. And they did this great interview with Earl Sweatshirt from Odd Future. And if anybody who has followed the sort of ups and downs of Odd Future, you may have read these weird profiles of them in terms of what they're doing in hip hop. But specifically, Earl Sweatshirt is this guy who at one point, you know, his mom freaked out and sent him to boarding school in Samoa and people thought he was missing. And it sounds very strange, but this was profiled like in The New Yorker, The New York Times. It was this weird kind of internet story. And his album dropped and they do this great interview with him. And he talks about meeting Paul McCartney,
who was in the studio in the New York Bureau on the same day. And there's a photo that is
that what happened?
At NPR Music that is the screensaver or the wallpaper. Paper for many, many people at NPR Music is this very bizarre photo of Earl Sweatshirt meeting Paul McCartney.
Yeah, and it's like a 19-year-old kid who you can tell on his face, he's like, this guy, like, Paul McCartney. and then also really fun moments where you hear, you know, Ali Shaheed Muhammad basically saying, hey, you're an artist, you need to kind of own this. And he's like it's just a great moment. If you love hip hop, it's a great moment to hear these two voices side by side. And then in the lesser category, this is making me happy right now, and I'm sure it will for the next couple of days. The James Franco, Seth Rogen, shot-by-shot reenactment of Kanye West's Kimye Bound 2 music video. I had never seen this video because I studiously avoided it on the first round when the internet was talking about it. So I had to see that, and you cannot unsee it. And so the remake, I'm not even going to spoil it for anyone. For all of you who want to go and check it out, I'm sure it is hitting your inboxes and Facebook feeds now, but I thought it was hilarious.
Wonderful. Thank you, Audie Cornish. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Kat at Kat Chow. That's KATCHOW. You can follow Audie Cornish at NPR Audie. That's NPRAUDIE. You can follow our absent pal, Trey Graham, at Trey Graham. Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow our absent pal, Glenn Weldon, at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer helping us out this week, Maggie Penman, at Maggie Penman, PENMAN. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including Intelligence Squared US, Oxford-style debates live from New York City. Intelligence Squared US brings together the world's leading authorities on the day's most important issues for intelligent discussion, grounded in facts and informed by reasoned analysis. Rethink your point of view, you know we'd like to do that, with Intelligence Squared US. Find it on iTunes under podcasts.